Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are talking about the 48 who never came home. And we are talking about the Stardust. Just before we do that, I know, look, we don't do Patreon plugs at the beginning of podcasts anymore, but I will say there are a few podcasts that have gone out this week in relation to the National Marine Planning Framework. I would ask people to check them out because what happened yesterday in the Dáil was a 55-minute obfuscation. It's important that people pay attention to what's happening, that this is going to be passed without any real scrutiny, and maybe go back and have a look at the two podcasts we did. We did one with a huge panel of vested interest, but I would say environmental NGOs. And we also had Ono Brin, who was, and we had Keane O'Callaghan, both TDs who've spoken against this, and not against the need for the National Marine Planning Framework, but against the idea of forcing it through without scrutiny. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin. How are you keeping?
Not too bad, Tony. And yourself?
It's Friday. This is my fourth recording of the day. You're just out of bed.
Get up for Joe. I always get up for Joe. Lifeline.
Listen, we are talking about the Stardust. And Martin, before we came on, you straight away went, yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, I was 13 when the Stardust happened, and it's not in living memory for a lot of people. But on the night, my dad was a taxi driver, my uncle was a taxi driver, and the taxi drivers from all over Dublin, as soon as they realized what was happening, they descended on the Stardust and they ferried people to hospitals. They put chains around bars on windows and tried to pull the bars off the windows. I remember the trauma. I remember how very traumatized everybody was, on the north side in particular. And it was just so shocking. And then, you know, years later, I worked with people who'd been in the Stardust and injured that night. And it's so ingrained in the north side memory, but it's the actual events of the night traumatized the whole of the country, but particularly the north side of Dublin.
Well, what we're here to talk about today is almost a continual trauma and re-traumatizing of the families and the survivors and the people who are engaged in. And we are delighted to be joined by Dara Mackin, who's a human rights lawyer with Phoenix Law, and Senator Lynn Boylan from Sinn Féin, who've both been, let's face it, Lynn, you've been involved heavily in the campaign of justice for the 48, and Dara, you've been helping represent people in an attempt to get some form of recompense and some form of justice for the situation that's gone on. Dara, can I come to you first and ask you, how have the last few months, really, since things have rolled on, where are we? And just give our listeners an understanding of why we need to keep pushing here.
So when you look at this in context, the reality is that the families at the Stardust have, for many, many years, been faced with failed investigation after flawed investigation, and have, despite those barriers, consistently and continuously fought for justice and a mechanism for truth and accountability. That mechanism came with the ordering of a new inquest and thought of a fresh application. The fresh application, having been prepared, commissioned by the families, with the help of for Lynn Boylan, the postcard campaign, the many other people who came out in support of the families. But the reality is that was only the first step in the road to truth and justice. And unfortunately for the families, there have been many barriers since. Obviously, this is an unprecedented inquest. It's an inquest never seen before in terms of complexity or size on the island of Ireland. But particularly so, given its importance, obviously the Stardust is, and I think, pretty uncontentious fact that it's the greatest loss of life in the history of the state. And the reality is that we're now being faced with further delays as a direct result of the inability to provide a quality of funding for the various families. What that effectively means, in summary terms, is that some families will qualify for representation at the pending inquest and others won't. And by virtue of the fact that they fall outside what's called the eligibility threshold, which means that they maybe have too much in their savings account, or that they earn too much as part of their employment, the threshold is extremely low. And the situation that now, as a result of that, is that some families qualify for funding for representation and some don't. I think it's a pretty stark set of affairs when in 2021 we're entering into a situation, even many years after all the various previous flawed investigations, we're now entering into a process at the minute in which families are being treated with no respect whatsoever for equality, no respect whatsoever for human rights. And it's kind of on the back of that quite troubling development that we now find ourselves meeting a further barrier in the road, which the families have had to continue to push the Minister of Justice to try and resolve it, to ensure that there's equality of treatment amongst all of the families and that all of the families are represented before the pending inquest.
Yeah, access to, we've often said on this podcast and across the platform that if you can't attest the right, you don't have it. And access to justice is, you know, should not be limited to this. And I, Lynn, I'm going to come to you because you have some concerns as well, given that it's gone through this process over the last few months, as you said, and you've been involved for a number of years on this.
We're just going to pause the podcast now for a couple of minutes because we are still doing these pleas, essentially, which are the pleas for you to, if you are enjoying what you listen to, if you like Tortoise Shack, if you wanted to stick around, we would ask you to support it. We would ask you to actually go beyond supporting it and show us that your support financially. And it is the Patreon model we rely on. It is that kind of crowdfund listeners, give us the price of a cup of coffee, and it helps us keep the mics on and having the conversations that you want to hear. And Martin, it's been nearly 3.5, coming up on 4 years now, and it just feels, yeah, it's phenomenal to see how it's grown. But that growth has to have sustainable. It has to be sustainable.
Ah, yeah, it has to be, Tony. There has to be money in the bank to be able to put out these podcasts. I mean, it does cost to host them, and it costs an arm and a bloody leg. And the more people listen, the more expensive it gets. So, you know, we have to grow both listenership and money.
I'm going to stop that because that's not true. We'll be done for saying that. But now we're facing a situation whereby, and you know, everybody's delighted, Helen McEntee has had a healthy baby boy. Congratulations to her and her partner. It's fantastic news. But we're facing a different Minister for Justice now who can, in effect, the hope is, or the fear is, that this could delay things even further.
Oh, absolutely. And I've raised it a couple of times now in the Seanad and sort of getting more and more frustrated because, and Dara can explain that the legalities of this just requires the minister to sign a statutory instrument. And this was, my frustration reached a peak over the height of all the mandatory hotel quarantine debates, that there were statutory instruments being signed on a daily basis to allow different people be exempt from the mandatory hotel quarantine. And yet, here's families that have waited 40 years to have access to justice. And the minister is saying, oh, we're looking at it, we're getting the Attorney General to look at it. And it's like, no, just sign the statutory instrument. The Act allows for a financial waiver. Just do it, get the job done. And if you really are genuine in saying that you want no barriers to the families, then this should have been the top of the list of things that the Department of Justice got done.
Dara, can I ask, it's been 40 years and there has never been an inquest that has satisfied the families in that time. Why is there such a reluctance on this?
I think the reality is that we are all aware of the underlying facts of the Stardust, but the reality is that what we've seen, you must again look at in context. We had an investigation previously by way of an inquiry that determined that the families were in effect arsonists. It's in my view, difficult to envisage a more ridiculous set of circumstances or a more disturbing set of circumstances. We had an event. We had then a review in 2012, which effectively determined that finding wasn't correct, that it was premised upon no evidence, and that finding should be removed from the inquiry report. Let's pause there to reflect on the fact that at no stage is there a further investigation held. At no stage is there any effort to actually then ascertain what exactly did happen. And then we proceed to what was known as the McCartan Review, which was ultimately had its hands tied behind its back in terms of how it could investigate the actual facts, because ultimately all it could do was ascertained whether the family's evidence was reliable or correct, but couldn't come to any conclusions to what those lines of inquiry may or may not lead to. So, for example, a very, very critical witness to the McCartan Review outlined, having been the first emergency caller, that the fire began in the roof space. It's a critical witness in terms of ascertaining where exactly the fire originated, and certainly a critical witness for determining how this fire was caused, or how the loss of life was caused in the way in which it was. None of those witnesses were even spoken to. None of them were give evidence on the record. And we end up in a situation where very many years later, despite all of the different independent evidence, despite the various advancements in expert evidence in particular, and despite the fact that a previous report has accepted that it was wrong to say it was arson, the families have never been given any mechanism to ascertain what actually did happen. I just think that, to me, bears a bit of reflection, because we're in a situation that the greatest loss of life, and the families are ultimately left with, we actually don't really know what happened. You may be right, but we're not going to do anything about it. And that, to me, is what beggars belief, because that's ultimately what led to the fresh inquest. The fresh inquest was down to the fact that there are so many lines of investigation that have not yet been pursued. And the reality is, as we all know, there are very, very serious questions that have to be answered, to include preventability, to include cover-up in the aftermath, and to include not just cover-up in respect of the immediate aftermath, but to include the state-sponsored cover-up that unfolded for many, many years afterwards. And it's against that backdrop that you can understand why families become extremely disturbed and indeed re-traumatized by these further delays, because we have a situation, Lynn has articulated pretty eloquently, where to resolve this problem would take no more than 15 minutes. A statutory instrument, a paragraph long, could resolve this problem. But yet here we are, almost a month from the last preliminary hearing, and we're no further on. And that is against the backdrop of the coroner making it clear on the record that this is the only basis to which this inquest is currently being delayed.
Sorry, Lynn, I know you've been involved with the campaign for a number of years, but some of the things that are being done here in terms of just access to justice, we're asking people for PPSN numbers and pay slips. It's like you're applying for a credit card or a personal loan and not actually just part of the justice system. It does seem very cold and inhumane.
And it's a very detailed form that the families are being asked to fill out. So what car you drive? You know, what are your weekly expenditure? And as Dara has rightly said, the threshold is very, very low in this country anyway for getting access to civil legal aid. But the fact that you would recognise that these families have been failed by the state, and time again, they have just been abused, I would say, systematically abused by the state. You then finally accept that by granting a new inquest, and it's in the public interest. And now you're going to say that we've done all of this to you. We've done this for 40 years. And now we're going to ask you for your bank statements, for your PPS number, for the car that you drive. So even the families, some families have...
It's like the insolvency service. It is though. I mean, as someone who has a long history in banking and we used to, you know, when they introduced the mortgage arrears process, this was the kind of, you know, how much would you spend on birthday parties and how much would you, and do you have Sky and do you need Sky? Would you not be better off? And when you see this sort of stuff...
And don't forget, this is very important in terms of the context of this as well. And I suppose how people who are in this situation when they come up against the state, and this state particularly, because we know they circle the wagons, but and the level of distrust that people have. When the first inquest failed the families, and the families tried to then take the owner of the nightclub to court to try and get justice for their loved ones, they were more or less corralled into accepting a compensation scheme that was designed by the state. And the threats were, if you continue, if you don't take this compensation and you continue down the road you're going of suing the owners of the Stars, you could lose your home. So all of that then comes back to the fore of, well, why am I being asked for all of this information? What does this mean? Is my house at risk? Do you know what I mean? So you can understand some families have gone through the process and have completed, but others are saying, I'm not giving that information because I don't trust what you're going to do with that information or what's going to happen and if I give that information.
It's just going to say that, Lynn, we have seen already, and this is ongoing, that the state is using back channels to gather data on people who may have cases against the state. Now, there's a lot of cynical actions in the last 40 years. It's not beyond the realms to think that that's exactly what's going on here. There is a liability limitation exercise underway. And it puts the government in a better position to know what the financial position of the families is. That puts them in a better position. It's a powerful position. Do you think there's something underhanded like that in there, or do you feel that there could be?
I might let Dara answer that one, because for me it's even just the perception of what's being done and that information being asked to give us, and the family's feelings about that sort of invasive nature. But I let Dara answer in terms of if what he thinks is behind the delay or the reason why they're pursuing the information.
I think Lynn's point spot on. This is about a perception of bias, not necessarily we have to prove bias. And there's a clear perception, because the reality is, I don't think there's any secret, that one outline of investigation to which the inquest will examine is state responsibility and state preventability. That's a core component of the Human Rights the European Convention on Human Rights. The reality is, it's the very same state that are now making families jump through every single loophole to satisfy and to receive equal treatment. And I think that what we have ultimately ended up in a situation is that the families who are ineligible or who won't provide the information, they feel that they may be the cause of the delay and as a result have re-traumatized people. And I don't say that lightly. I say that because that is the reality, unfortunately. People have become deeply traumatized by this whole event. They've been deeply distressed because they see it as a huge delay at the hands of, by virtue of their ineligibility. And the reality is that's the furthest thing from that. It's the very same state that whose actions will have to be part of the consideration in any investigation in due course. It's the very same state that's now acting in a manner that's clearly procrastinating in respect of ensuring a quality of treatment for the Stardust families. And I have to say, I read with interest the various answers. And for example, one of the answers to Senator Boylan's question about this exact issue. And we keep seeing time and time again this issue of how much money has been pledged to the Stardust inquest. The reality is that's more than paying lip service to the reality of the situation. It's not about how much money has been paid to the Stardust inquest. The reality is none of that money has been paid to any of the families. None of that money has been made available to the families. And we have a situation where all of that money is only being paid or only being used to pay rent in a building that nobody can get access to because of the very same delays in the inquest starting. And it's a circular position. And I think that that has to be a matter of great concern to the wider public. The public funds are being expended in a way which ultimately there will be no end in sight and the overheads will continue to be expended without the families having access to justice.
This is so typical, though, where we see this we've thrown money at the problem. We're not talking about where it's actually been put. And I suppose the key issue that you've repeated several times, Dara, is equality of access, equality of under the law, and how people can actually gain access. And to go back to Martin's point, we're not inferring malfeasance here, but we're saying there's after decades of this going on so long, people can, I would be naturally feeling that, where is the level of trust? Trust is earned, not just given. And unfortunately, that relationship seems very damaged by this. If, is this just because, I know you're saying it can be fixed by the stroke of a pen, but is this because the state chose to use this mechanism as opposed to another alternative that might have made it a simpler method for everybody to avail of, because we've seen, I don't know if you noticed recently, whereby we had the first mass action in Ireland, because we don't do class action. We had a mass action whereby the Facebook leak that has taken place has resulted in, you pay your 50 quid and in you go to this mass action against this thing. Are we in a situation here whereby just by the nature of this inquest, this is how it's done, and the state then with the balance of power, because they hold the purse strings, still remains more in their favor.
Well, I should say that Tony, there is an element to that, that is correct. But the reality is, the very start of this inquest, it was actually us, it was actually, you know, the families who approached the Department of Justice and said, this is an exceptional case. It's not built for the current process. Here's a number of alternatives as to how you resolve this. That at first instance actually went ignored. It wasn't until many months into the process that the engagement began. And that engagement ultimately concluded with the department's view being that we should proceed via the legal aid route. That, you know, reluctantly we decided to proceed down that route. We didn't think it was the best value for money, given the circumstances in which and the length of time the inquest would run. And also, we didn't think it was the best option for the families. But for all of those reasons, and given the department had decided, we proceeded with it. The situation now arises is that it's become clear from the legal aid route that there is a provision that allows for the waiving of financial eligibility, i.e. there's a provision there that says the Legal Aid Board can disregard your financial eligibility where it's in the interest of the justice to do so, effectively. The problem is that for the Legal Aid Board to exercise that power, they need to have regulations in place from the minister. So we have this unique position whereby the Legal Aid Board retain the power to actually disregard financial eligibility, but without the guidance from the minister in the form of regulations, they can't exercise that power. So it all comes back to this point. We simply just want regulations. It's no more than a paragraph long. It'll take 15 minutes to draft. The reality is what we're asking for here is not very complex. We just simply want the eligibility criteria disregarded for those families who are ineligible. And I should say that, you know, you must look at this in the backdrop. If you were charged with a taking of life, you wouldn't have to fill out these forms. You would be automatically guaranteed the legal aid. And quite rightly so, that's the way the justice system works. But here we have families who are participating in the greatest the biggest investigation into the biggest loss of life, and yet they are met with a whole different type of barrier that doesn't exist elsewhere.
Yeah, and I'd like to come back to that, is that we have to remember that 48 of, you know, of the Northside Ireland's young people died that night, and nobody has been found responsible for that. Nobody has been found to have been negligent in any of their actions. It's just a black hole, and it has disappeared for 40 years into this black hole, and there has been no accountability from anybody for anything. That has to be terribly traumatic on the families, in that it's unfinished business and it'll never be finished until the full story is heard. How are the families coping at the present moment with this, Lynn? How are they managing? It's a huge weight.
And you're right. And when you suppose come into contact with families and groups of survivors, it's intergenerational, the impact of this. It just keeps passing down until justice is seen to be done. Families will pass the hurt and the pain down through the generations. And particularly struck me on Monday when I raised it in the Seanad with nobody from the Department of Justice showed up. They sent in Minister Frank Feehan from the Department of Health. But he came out, in fairness to him, he came out and met with the families outside the gate afterwards. And Samantha Mangan, whose mother died that night, and, you know, was a single mother, and she woke up the next morning and her mother was gone from her life. And she put it to Minister Feehan, I dropped my kids off this morning at school and they asked me, where are you going? And she said, I'm going back to Leinster House to protest for justice for my mother. And she's like, I'm now 44 years of age. She said, and my kids now know the campaign for justice. And it continues. And that's the generation. And until this is resolved, that's going to keep happening. And people are re-traumatized. But also each generation is going to pass down the pain and the hurt and the unanswered questions.
I don't want to. In the same week where we saw only yesterday, the Garda Commissioner make a statement saying that there's not enough evidence in the Mother and Baby Homes report to prosecute anybody for some of the acts that happened. And we see these things whereby it it would be wrong of me not to say that I feel that a lot of this comes back down to reducing the state's liability in some of these matters and reducing the flow out. And again, we'll actually, on for listeners' benefits, we'll be returning to that on Sunday with Noelle Brown, who was born in a mother and baby home. But nonetheless, that intergenerational trauma is profound. Like, I mean, you're still asking those questions. Sorry, Lynn.
No, and it's interesting that you say that about the state and minimizing their liability, because Owen is writing a book at the moment about the latent defects, and he went back through various government documents and found that at the time of the Stardust, the discussion at the cabinet table was how do we not be held accountable for this, because they didn't implement building regulations. So that the conversation was around the building regulations. And the point that Owen has made by looking at the record throughout history is that every time somebody has to die before we change regulations. So we had the tenements collapse. Stardust.
We need a tragedy. Yeah. But unfortunately, when I look at what's happening in emergency accommodation for profit at the moment, and you know, the lack of general fire safety, and we've dealt with some of the stuff that Brendan Kenny has said and where the certificates are and where the safety is. But I want to come back to topic and just ask Dara. I know it's a very simple thing to ask Dara in terms of, you know, it's, we want one paragraph, we want one signature, we want this done. How do we make them? How do we bring that, drag that horse to water?
I think that's the, unfortunately, the depressing truth in all of this is that I'm not sure there's any great remedy other than a political and public pressure and potential litigation. I have to say, it would be with great regret if the families have to go back to court to simply get access to justice on an equal basis. And I hope that the wider public interest, and certainly the wider public interest, has got the families to where they are now by virtue of, for example, the postcard campaign, etc. So I dare say that I think that the issue here in terms of trying to drag the minister to the position that the regulation is made, I think, unfortunately, the most important aspect in trying to resolve that or to get into that demand is by virtue of the wider public interest and making it clear at every opportunity that the wider public requires, certainly, you know, the law requires equality before the courts, not only equality before the courts, but where there is the loss of life, that people, individuals, victims have access to justice.
Lynn, is there a way that individuals can help here? Can they ring TDs? Can they send emails? Is there some pressure that can be exerted?
Yeah, I suppose we're looking at how we can, I suppose, mobilise both within the institutions themselves and do what we did in terms of the postcard campaign and that cross-political support, because there is cross-political support among the political parties and independents for this, but also asking that members of the public, in the same way that they did with those postcards, show that this is a matter of interest to you. This is not just about the 48 victims of the fire and their families. This is about the people of Ireland want this done. So I would encourage them to write to both their local TDs and let them know that you're, you know, a constituent of them. Nobody gets attention better in an email as to let a TD or a senator know that you're in their constituency. But particularly write to the Department of Justice and ask that this be done, because our real fear is that now that Minister McEntee is gone on maternity leave, that this will just be dragged out for another 6 months until she comes back into the role, because basically we've an interim caretaker minister. So that's the big fear, and that just can't be allowed to happen. You know, time is ticking on and nobody's getting any younger. So
okay, and I'd like to thank both Dara and Lynn for coming on and having this chat with us. And I'd like to thank the families of the 48 for letting us share this story. You know, we need this to happen. If 40 years, it's just way too long. It's way too long. These people deserve justice. And thank you again for taking the time to come on and chat to us about this.
Can I say one thing just to close? It's you'd always think we should just do the right thing. But it's bloody hard sometimes to get people just to do the right thing. So just to go, like, just the simplest of things. So yeah, do actually agitate. Do let them know and do send it, whether it's a 2-line email, that's all it is. So it's 45 seconds out of your day, but it makes all the difference, because if they get a few hundred of these 2-line emails, that's when people sit up and pay attention. And we will be pushing this now. So we'll see this on all our channels. But again, thanks Lynn Boylan and Dara Macken for joining us today. And we hope to be back in your feeds very soon. Talk to you all soon. Take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.